Mary presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. Okay, our first matter on calendar this morning is Schultz versus Taylor, docket number 53731. Are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you like to reserve any time?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 to 3 minutes.
Okay.
Chief Justice Perigary, members of the court, good morning. My name is Harry Swainston. I represent the appellants in this matter. This court published two significant opinions in the last 70 years which addressed the retroactivity and constitutionality of water right forfeiture statutes. Henry Waters of Man Springs, 1940 case, Town of Eureka versus State Engineer, a 1992 case. Town of Eureka dealt with a permitted water right to percolating water. Man Springs dealt with a pre-1913 common law appropriation of spring water. The Schultz family water rights in this case are pre-19 common law appropriations to water from a defined aquifer. We contend that the district court erred in citing the Town of Eureka case for the proposition that NRS 534.090 subsection 1 is retroactively applicable to the Schultz water rights and is constitutional. We contend that the court should have relied upon the Man Springs case for the rule that was established in that case, which would have protected the Schultz water rights from the threat of a forfeiture proceeding. The reasons behind our contentions are straightforward. The law that was applicable to the spring water rights in the Man Springs case are also applicable to the Schultz water rights. Prior to 1939, there were but two classes of water in the state of Nevada. One was percolating groundwater. The other was comprised of surface water, water from a defined aquifer, and artesian water. Percolating water was not regulated until 1939. The other three components of the second class were regulated for the first time by the Act of March 22, 1913. These two classifications were set forth in this court's opinion in the 1881 case of Strait versus Brown, where it was emphasized by the court that each of these cases, the law applicable to each of these cases, was distinctly different. The state engineer does not appear to question these classes, and in fact, he affirmatively stated in his answer that the Schultz family water rights were to water from a defined aquifer. Thus, they were subject to the same law as a spring water right in the Man Springs case. The rule of Man Springs is a constitutional rule. It provides that where the law in effect at the time of the appropriation provided only for abandonment as a mechanism for its loss, then the water right was protected by subsequently enacted forfeiture statutes. This court in Man Springs denied the application of a forfeiture statute, that would be Section 8 of the 1913 Act, to the spring water right in Man Springs. The Schultz family water rights come squarely within the protection of the rule of Man Springs, and also squarely within the protection of another provision of the 1913 Act, the non-impairment section, that would be section 84. Now, this may come as a shock, but even though that section now resides in chapter 533, we contend that that non-impairment statute still fully applies to protect the Schultz water rights. The scope of the rule of Man Springs can't be fully appreciated as to its application to the Schultz water rights without an understanding of the terms undetermined right and determined right that exist in the forfeiture statute. We contend that the district court erred by not resolving the meaning of these terms. These terms came into existence in Section 9A of the Act of March 15, 1947, where it was provided that 5 years of non-use of groundwater would work a forfeiture of undetermined rights, but an abandonment of determined rights. Now, this is an important issue because, in fact, if the Schultz water rights were within the classification of determined rights, that means that by the express terms of Section 9A of the 1947 statute, they would be only subject to intentional abandonment and not forfeiture. At the time of the amendment to Section 9A, in 1967, they would be protected from forfeiture by the rule of Man Springs, and thereafter, they would be protected to the present time by the rule of Man Springs. Section 9B of the 1947 statute recognized the historic distinction between water in a defined aquifer and percolating groundwater, and defined vested rights to each of them. Authority was given to the state engineer to make the technical determination as to whether the water was either one or the other. He has done that with respect to the Schultz water rights. Now they may be fully described as determined pre-1913 vested rights to water from a defined aquifer. We submit that such rights were included in the definition of determined rights in Section 9B or 9A of the 1947 Act. This is consistent with their prior constitutional protection provided for by the rule of Man Springs, and also the statutory protection provided for by the non-impairment statute. We submit, Your Honors, that in reaching a reasoned decision in this case, all that needs to be done is for you to judicially apply the rule of Man Springs. The state engineer consulted several dictionaries.
Mr. Swainston,
Your Honor.
It is suggested that in the Eureka case, that the legislature in 1947 overturned or modified the Man Springs rule. What say you about that suggestion?
Well, in order for the statute to be retroactive to...
I'm not talking about its retroactive application.
Pardon your...
I'm not talking about its retroactive application. I'm talking about it modifying the underpinnings of Man Springs jurisprudence altogether.
Well, that's what I was going to say. In order for that to happen, they would have, for it to be retroactive back to that time, they would have had to nullify the rule of Man Springs. But there's no police power basis for that to happen, which I will discuss momentarily.
Well, if there is, but the application of that was treated as a prospective application, not retroactive.
Well, so I'm not understanding your question exactly, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll continue. The state engineer consulted several dictionaries for definitions of undetermined and determined. And he offered different definitions to the district court and to this court, both of which produced absurd results when they were inserted in the statute. The state engineer's rejection of the Schultz suggestion as to their meanings left these terms hopelessly ambiguous. Now, where the meaning of critical terms of a statute, particularly a forfeiture statute, is left to guesswork, then the statute is unconstitutionally vague. We contend that the district court erred in failing to consider that the statute was void for vagueness. Surface water and water in a defined aquifer started out being legally and functionally equivalent. As I've indicated, there's nothing that can be identified in the statutes or case law that has made them different than what they were from the beginning. We contend that continued beneficial use is not a present requirement that can be constitutionally applied to water in a defined aquifer because the legislature in 1999 repealed that requirement as to surface water. A suitable basis to distinguish them without imposing an unconstitutional discrimination is impossible. We contend that the district court erred in failing to address the serious substantive due process and equal protection problems which attend the lack of a suitable police power basis for the imposition of forfeiture. Because loss by abandonment only was expressly conferred on the determined rights in Section 9A of the 1947 Act, the statute in 1967 cannot be made retroactive as to those water rights unless the rule of Mann Springs was nullified. But the only articulated police power basis for doing so has been repealed. We contend that retroactivity must be limited to water rights that are undetermined rights and which necessarily include permits that have been granted by the state engineer. I'll continue momentarily. The district court erred by delegating judicial power to the state engineer to conduct the forfeiture proceeding. NRS itself is unconstitutional on its face in that it also directs the state engineer to exercise a power that is reserved to the judiciary. Our contention is supported by this court's opinion in Ormsby County versus Kearney, a 1914 case that dealt with similar issues. This court seems to have adopted our position in the 2008 case of Howell versus State Engineer. I'll reserve the balance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Brian Stockton, Senior Deputy Attorney General representing the Nevada State Engineer. The Schultz in this case asked this court to overrule at least three of your prior decisions. The first one that they've asked you to overrule is Town of Eureka. And the difference between Town of Eureka and Mance Springs is inconsequential. If this court buys the arguments that are being made here, it will overrule the Town of Eureka. In Town of Eureka, they've talked a little bit about the police power, but in that ruling, this court held that the legislature does have police power over water rights and to prescribe how those water rights can be used in order to protect the health and welfare of the citizens of Nevada. The second case that will have to be overruled is Preferred Equities, where this court held that the preeminent policy of Nevada water law is beneficial use. And I've talked to you before about the state engineer's goal to try and make maximum beneficial use without damaging these resources. And these are the statutes that play into that balance so that we can protect the groundwaters of the state. The third case is the back case, because now speculators will be able to buy pre-1967 water rights and be able to hold those without a beneficial use and come in at a later date and supplant the junior users by asserting these rights that may not have been used for 40 or 50 years. And so that's the balance that this court has to find when it's deciding this case, because that's squarely at issue, because what you have is the basic tension between beneficial use to have enough water for everybody to use and the property rights of the Scholes family. Those are the two conflicting interests in this case. Now, Mr. Swainson talked about beneficial use being repealed because surface water can no longer be lost by forfeiture. The legislature made that change. But I just assert real quickly that revocation by implication is disfavored. And I'll talk later about the differences. But they also talk about this being a new source. But the Carson Valley Ground Hydrographic Basin, where these water rights are, is fully appropriated. So any water that's resurrected from a prior vested right is going to supplant newer junior water rights, and those are going to have to be cut off to keep this basin in balance. So that's another part of the balance that you have to weigh in deciding which of the interests in this case is more important.
Why specifically, if you could explain to me, is there a distinction between the surface water rights that can't be forfeited and the groundwater rights?
Okay, and that... I don't want to go into the history, but under equal protection analysis, the legislature has basically made two classes of water rights. There's the surface water rights and the groundwater rights. And so the standard is, if I can articulate a reason the legislature might have done that, then it passes constitutional muster for equal protection purposes. Surface water, as you know from prior cases, if it runs by the senior appropriator, then a junior appropriator can use it. If it runs by the junior appropriator and it gets to the end of the system, then either the fish or the wildlife or whatever can use it on most river systems, not all of the major river systems. But that water gets used by something or someone at some point. Groundwater, on the other hand, it moves much more slowly. It does move, but it kind of stays put more. And most of these basins have what they call transitional storage in them. Most of the basins in Nevada hold millions of acre feet of water, but only so many thousands of those acre feet are recharged every year. And so that's where we get back to that perennial yield analysis. And so what happens in groundwater is it ameliorates the drought. If there's a drought this year, you can still pump the same amount of water, because when there's a wet year, it'll balance out the aquifer, and the state engineer calls that when they come into equilibrium.
Well, isn't that the same thing as the surface water? It's, some years it'll run... greater than other years, and when it runs at a trickle, and the rights are cut off according to priority.
Okay. I'd hope to avoid this, but the bottom line is the main reason the legislature changed the statute was in reaction to the Alpine cases. What the Ninth Circuit did there is TCID had told all these farmers, those are the federal water rights, they're not yours, you can't change them. Then the United States Supreme Court said, no, they belong to the user. You could have changed them. Then the Ninth Circuit said, well, if you didn't, you should have known those were your water rights, even though TCID told you they weren't, and you should have tried to change them, and since you didn't try to change them, they're forfeited. That's the scenario that led to the legislature making this change. And so that's for background, that's what it is.
Mr. Stockton, let me ask you this. Since Mad Springs, the 1940 Nevada Supreme Court decision was entered, what legislative changes have occurred that would affect the impact of the Mad Springs case?
Well, the changes that occurred, Justice Hardesty already talked about the 1947 change.
Right.
And then in 1967, the legislature changed the language of the statute to its current form. And then it was modified a little bit in 1981 to clarify some of the provisions. And that's what I wanted to talk about in this ambiguity argument is the Scholes wants you to focus myopically on determined and undetermined. But the rule of statutory construction is you read a statute as a whole. And if you read the whole thing there, they changed it that year. They said for five successive years after April 5th, 1967 was added in 1981, to clarify that the statute did not divest water rights that hadn't been used up to 1967. The conduct of non-use had to happen after 1967. So that kind of started the clock on when these water rights would be could be subject to forfeiture, because what the legislature did is put all water right holders on notice that your conduct from now on counts, and if you don't use those waters for 5 years, we're going to let somebody else use them. And then they also changed the statute. They said on the part of any right, and they added the language that said whether it's an adjudicated right, an unadjudicated right, or a permitted right. And as you know, permitted rights apply to rights that have been perfected under the statute. Vested rights, such as the ones we're talking about here, have to be go through an adjudication process. And that's under 533.090 up to 533.320. And there's all these steps that have to go on. And the district court issues the final decree on these vested rights, for the most part. There's always exceptions in the water law. So so what they said in the first part of that statute is it applies to all water rights, adjudicated, unadjudicated, permitted. And so that put everybody on notice that all rights were subject to this statute. And whether determined or undetermined, it's my position that I intended to be consistent all the way through from the district court to this court. I may have used different words. But determined means you know what it is. Undetermined means you don't know what it is. There is no third category there. It's either determined or undetermined. And Mr. Swainston is trying to substitute different words in here to make this confusing. But in my mind, determined and undetermined are the entire universe of water rights. And so there is nothing else, and the statute is clear.
So what is an undetermined right in your view?
An undetermined right is a right that exists, but it's not known because it hasn't been determined yet. If you have a vested right, that right exists, but it's not known as to quantity. If you look at the Capert versus United States case, the background facts, what happened there, the Caperts came in with a change application to change their water rights. And I think it was Ash Meadows, but don't hold me to that. They were farmers in Ash Meadows, but their pumping was drawing down the Devil's Hole. The National Park Service came to the state engineer and said, we have this reserved water right. You can't let the Caperts pump their water here. The state engineer says, you haven't quantified it. We don't know what it is. And so the state engineer granted the Caperts change applications. The United States then went to federal district court, quantified their right, and the state engineer said, okay, now that we know what your water right is, we know that we have to cut off these certain wells to protect that federally reserved water right. So that's the, and I forget where I was going with that. I apologize.
Well, let me ask this question. While there is an interesting difference of opinion about undetermined and determined rights, if the 1967 amendment is constitutional, it doesn't seem to matter because the forfeiture extends to both under the 67 statute.
Correct.
So the real question is whether this court should revisit Eureka.
Correct.
And its constitutional analysis as it applies to the Schultz family.
Correct. And that's I think that's the first thing I said, is they're asking you to overrule Town of Eureka.
Because Town of Eureka. And on that score.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And on that score, what is your view about Mr. Swainston's argument about the scope of the police power of the legislature in its 67 enactment?
The police power is, as I said before, is to protect the health and welfare of the citizens of the state. And I would suggest that there's nothing more important to life in this state than water. Admittedly, air and sunshine, we have to have those both too. But I would be willing to bet everybody in this room has utilized water in some way already today. And there's nothing more vital to life than water. And so that's where we get the legislative declaration of beneficial use being the highest priority. And this court has said it's the preeminent factor in our water law. Police power. If you look at the case law cited by the Schultzes, they talk about that energy resources case from the United States Supreme Court. That was a Kansas statute that was regulating the price of natural gas. And the Supreme Court went through all this analysis and said, yes, that's within the police power of the state. I would suggest that water is much more important to us than is the price of natural gas. And this court in town of Eureka held that the police power did extend to water. And even in Mance Springs, this court held that the state, having the right to designate the method of appropriation, may also provide how long waters may be permitted to run idly by and not be beneficially used. So this court's consistent jurisprudence, which would have to be overruled in toto, is that the police power of the state does extend to water and would extend to this level because, and it's constitutional because the legislature only affected prospective conduct. They didn't, they put people on notice. If you don't use your water rights, you're going to lose them. We're going to let somebody else use them. Now, you asked us to address several other issues I'd like to just hit quickly. As to equity, the Army's Inspector General Corps has a motto. It says, first be right, then take action. And I always thought there was an equitable maximum that equity casts a wide net, but I've never been able to find that in all my research. But the idea is that when you sit in equity and you want to give relief to one person, you need to think about all the people that are going to be hurt by helping this person out. And those are the junior water rights users who are going to lose their water rights and be, you know, subject to divestment at a later date because there might be other vested water rights that come behind. So if you change the law to allow these vested water rights to be resurrected, then the junior water rights users are on the bubble where they're going to have to buy out the senior vested rights. As far as issue preclusion, I admit I didn't use the words issue preclusion in my brief, and I apologize for that. But the entire analysis of the Mance Springs case, that section of my brief, goes towards the change in the law. And in order for issue preclusion to apply, the law, the issues have to be the same. And if the law is different, then the issues are different. So, and then as far as the Bill of Attainder is a legislative pronouncement that singles out someone for punishment without any judicial process. And if you look at the Shoals reply brief, it's not that there's no judicial process. They just don't like the judicial process. They're getting there, and they want more. The administrative review is not good enough, and they'd like to have a de novo trial. So just in conclusion, I realize the forfeiture law is not popular with the courts, and in my 4 years of practicing water law, I've never won a forfeiture case yet. But still, I think the courts have to think about this balance between the beneficial use, allowing people to use water while at the same time protecting the resource. And if you allow these water rights to sit idle while nobody's using them, and then we let somebody else start to use the water, then they're going to have to be cut off later. And so the Schultzes are not speculators. I'm not saying that. But speculators will be able to buy up these old water rights and just sit on them until the market's right. And then they can pounce in, divest the junior rights, and cash in. And so it's our position that the one thing I'd like to talk about on the equitable issue, too. I only have 20 seconds left. Remember what the district court did here. The district court remanded this to the state engineer to make the findings of fact. The state engineer is prepared to do that. We can litigate that in the district court. Summary judgment on the issue of forfeiture should not have been appealable, and that should have waited until an appeal on the merits because it's still de novo review, so the Schultzes would not have been injured by that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Swainson, you got about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Mr. Stockton, I think, misleads the court in some respects. Beneficial use is indeed important, but it's the basis and the measure of the right when it's initially acquired, and that's the limit to it. Continued beneficial use, there's no question about it. The state legislature has repudiated that as a policy matter. Mr. Stockton says You know, this statute applies to all water rights whenever they were created, as long back as you can imagine. And he says all the state has to do is just show a conceivable state interest in doing so, and he presents a parade of horribles if it doesn't happen, and a bunch of other stuff if it does happen. But the thing is, the rational basis test, according to modern jurisprudence, is not the test. The recent case out of the United States Supreme Court, District of Columbia versus Heller, a 2008 gun control case involving the Second Amendment, addressed the standards of scrutiny that the courts have to apply when the law infringes an enumerated power, and here it's the unconstitutional taking of property without just compensation.
Mr. Swainston, would you mind, I'm going to try my question one more time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Stockton argues that your position on appeal would result in overturning the Eureka case. I'd like to know whether you agree with that assessment, or if not, then why doesn't a decision in this case run counter to Eureka? Because Eureka pretty clearly discusses Mann Springs and says that the Mann Springs decision, as a result of the 67 statutory amendment, is no longer good law. So it does seem as though your contention calls for the court to overrule Eureka. And if that's true, then what is defective in the analysis in the Eureka opinion, in your view?
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes, you may.
Well, I think there's a choice. You either overrule or revisit Town of Eureka and limit it to its facts, or you have to overrule Mann Springs. Now, the facts of Eureka were that it dealt with a permitted water right to percolate in groundwater. And I've argued myself that those rights are subject to forfeiture. Particularly, they're subject to forfeiture because they're administratively created permits. What Mr. Stockton is saying is that, oh, you know, permits are well known and they're definite, and so they come within the definition of determined rights. And so those can't be abandoned under the 1947 statute, and unless the rule of Mann Springs is nullified, they have to be protected by the 1967 and later versions of the forfeiture statute, which in effect means that the Town of Eureka case was wrongly decided. Mr. Stockton is calling for this court to overrule Town of Eureka, not the Schultzes. I don't know if I've completely answered your question, Your Honor, but...
Chief, could I ask Mr. Swainston a question?
Sure.
Mr. Swainston, on the I'm intrigued by your constitutional law argument on the strict scrutiny versus rational basis, and I'm thinking out your analogy to the gun control law. Do you know of any authority that says that water rates are reviewed under strict scrutiny? Because I know we have this Foothills versus Fernley LLC. Case, the District of Nevada concluded it's a rational basis review there, but that's a district court. But I'm just wondering if any appellate courts have held that it's strict scrutiny for review of this type of statute.
No, I'm not aware of any of those kind of cases, Your Honor. You have to look at whether there's an enumerated right that's implicated in the process, because that makes all the difference.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Counsel, thanks so much for your briefs and your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. and the court will stand in recess until 11:30.